Probably a parent can tell, wanting to talk about compassion tonight. We're living in this COVID-19 era. And we could see COVID as one of the heavenly messengers of illness and dying. I know some of you are like, wait a second. She hasn't even like said two sentences and she's talking about COVID. She's landing us in COVID and it's the beginning of the talk. It's like, yes, COVID is here. And I really want to talk about compassion. And we'll get to the beauty of compassion, some practical ways of working with it. One of the supportive conditions for the arising of compassion is an openness and a receptivity to dukkha, to this wide range of experience that's blowing through our lives. So we're going to talk about COVID because, well, COVID is dukkha, dukkha, dukkha. So we could see COVID as one of the four heavenly messengers of illness and dying. The heavenly messengers of aging, illness, death, and a monastic all set the Buddha on his noble search for, is there another way to be with dukkha? And it's a search that not totally like our own, but has some similarities, some parallels. And this path of practice that we've been cultivating, right? These four heavenly messengers can start to have us ask questions, right? How do we live knowing that aging, illness, and death are assured? That loss is a guarantee at some point in our life. Our time here is finite. As my Uncle Charles is very fond of saying, ain't none of us getting out of here alive. For me, the cemetery contemplations, the death of my aunt in 2018, and the recent death of my godfather earlier this month, have been heavenly messengers for me. And one of the gifts of these heavenly messengers has been a clarification of what really matters to me. And again, my heart is just revolving around, like, how do I live into love no matter the conditions? COVID, no COVID, political unrest of our times, political unrest abating a bit. How do I live into love no matter what? And this learning to love is the terrain of the Brahma Viharas and what we cultivate on this path. And I know I've read this quote to you all before, but it has meant so much to me, and it is really speaking to me lately. And it feels so connected to compassion. So again, this is from McGill, talking about how our meditative experience shapes our relationship to the world and each other. He says, doing this deep work and really arriving here, being interested in here, discovering the samadhi, collectedness of mind, the settledness, this happiness, this contentment, this deep work of equanimity, of just being here, transforms us into people who are peacemakers in this world. People who get back into the world with compassion and care for the world in an important way. It's not an escape. This practice is not an escape. It's a preparation, a sacred preparation for the sacred work of caring for each other in this world that we live in. So when I think of the Brahma Viharas, sometimes this image comes to mind. Can you see him? Can you all see this image? Okay, good. I see some of you smiling, which means you've all probably, you know who this being is. This is Mingyur Rinpoche. He's a monastic and a teacher. He's described as a Tibetan meditation master. He wrote a book called In Love with the World. I don't know if any of you have had a chance to read it. It's a really personal, honest, intimate account of his 3 years in retreat. He was wandering as an anonymous yogi. And he's a Rinpoche, right? So in order to take on this 3 year retreat, he had to relinquish everything. Everything. All of his responsibilities as an abbot of his monasteries, all of his titles, all of the reverence afforded a Rinpoche and a Tulku, his very sheltered life, very protected life, he had to relinquish and let go. And he did this without telling anybody he was going to do it. He didn't tell his brothers, didn't tell his beloved attendant, didn't tell any of the young monastics that he was training. He didn't even tell his mama, right? Because he understood if he was going to practice in the way that he needed to, he had to leave in secret and let it all go. Right? So he leaves everything. And it's about a year into the retreat, and his whereabouts are discovered. And once it's discovered where he is, he decides to write a letter. And he gives this letter to someone who's a part of his Sangha. Someone had stumbled onto him during this first year of his retreat. So he's discovered. And he writes a letter to his friends, his family, and his Sangha. And this Sangha member takes it back. And then he continues on with his retreat for 2 more years. And at the time that he was writing this letter, Mingyur was living in a rundown hotel with very, very little food and meager clothing. And here's an excerpt from that letter. I myself am wandering without any fixed location, staying in isolated mountain hermitages and other such places. I have experienced feelings of happiness and suffering, rising and falling like waves on the surface of the ocean. At times, food and clothing have been hard to come by, and I have felt cold, hungry, and thirsty. Even when I beg for alms, I have received nothing but insults and harsh words. Remember, this is a Rinpoche. A lot of status. None of that's there to protect him. Even when I have begged for alms, I've received nothing but insults and harsh words. At other times, I've received food and clothing effortlessly, without even asking for them. While I've experienced both happiness and suffering, the most important thing is that a deep and heartfelt sense of certainty has arisen in the depths of my being, such that no matter what happens, I know that the true nature of these experiences, their very essence, is that of timeless awareness and vast compassion. No matter what happens, I know that the true nature of these experiences, their very essence, is that of timeless awareness and vast compassion. But compassion has this potential to be an ally, a balm, and a companion as we navigate the turbulence of our times. So I'm wanting to explore it for that reason. I want to explore compassion because it's an expression of a free heart and mind. As we talked about last week, full awakening is the uprooting of the taints, and it reveals the heart's true nature. And the taints are ignorance, desire, sense desire, and what's the third taint? Desire for becoming. And we've each had a foretaste of this freedom. It's not full liberation. Actually, I might be underestimating some of you, like you might be fully awakened. And if we're not, the seeds are still there. But there are moments when the manifestation of greed, aversion, and delusion come from the taints. I've actually abated and they're not active in the heart mind stream. This is a foretaste of a heart that's free of agitation. You may have experienced this on retreat or just in your daily life when the strategy of craving has actually abated. And abiding in the Brahma Viharas, abiding in compassion, especially as a radiating practice. It's a very beautiful practice. We just arouse compassion. And then one way of playing with this radiating practice of all of the Brahma Viharas with compassion, we don't use the phrases as we did in the guided meditation. We just arouse the karuna, compassion. And the way that it was taught to me as this radiating practice is after you arouse it, you just rest in it. And the third step is you just allow it to radiate out in like all directions. So arousing karuna, arousing compassion. I know there's some of you are wanting to have the Pali word spelled. So karuna, K-A-R-U-N-A, K-A-R-U-N-A, karuna. We simply, when we're arousing compassion, we just simply call on an image, phrases, memory. You can... if you have a real connection with compassion, you can just recall the feeling, and sometimes it's just present, it's aroused. And it's just this wish, this genuine wish for all beings, particular being, ourselves, to be free from affliction. It actually takes up the vision of freedom as the object of our awareness. Now with this practice, we're inviting karuna to just arise in the heart to whatever degree however it manifests. And it can be very intense, strongly felt. It can be really soft. It can be even neutral. Whatever degree it manifests in it as it's arising, as long as there's an absence of cruelty, a far enemy of compassion, and as long as it's absent of other afflictive heart mind states, consider it compassion. Consider it karuna. I remember being at the forest refuge practicing with Venerable and just learning this radiating practice for the first time. And it was so different from the metta practice that I was learning at Spirit Rock and had been doing for some years with the phrases and the momentum of that. Like, it's gradually built over the days and weeks. And then this particular retreat, we were working with the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, the Brahma Viharas, and then another practice. And it was a month. So we didn't have a full month with the Brahma Viharas. So it was feeling really different for me. I was so used to metta, like kind of rolling through with a ton of strength. And with the metta at this retreat, it just wasn't feeling as strong. So I went to Venerable and Ali and I was like, I'm doing this right. And he's like, well, just describe to me what's happening. So we're walking and I'm describing. And he's like, so is there any cruelty? And I was like, no. He's like, are there any like afflictive mind states at all arising in you? I'm like, no. And he's like, just call it metta. Don't dither. It's like, no, but that's the presence of the Brahma Vihara, right? So we just arouse the Brahma Vihara, these heavenly abodes, these four of them: metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. We just arouse compassion. With the radiating practice, the next step is then we just rest. And this marks the shift from the kind of doing aspect of arousing the compassion through some image, a phrase, maybe just recalling the felt sense of compassion in the heart mind. But when we move to like resting, I have a teacher who says, we move from doing metta or doing compassion to being compassion. So once it's present, you just rest in the inner atmosphere of karuna, compassion, and you can invite it to fill and suffuse and imbue the body. And if you find at any point during this that it starts to abate or it totally disappears, that's okay. You just go back to arousing the compassion, arousing karuna. And then when it feels like there's some steadiness, just rest. What's interesting about all of these Brahma Viharas or compassion is that it's a conditioned state. So until fully awakened, compassion will arise, it's going to persist as change, and then it's going to just disappear. And that's okay. Until we're fully awakened, it's going to be a conditioned state. When it abates, which it'll inevitably do, we just arouse it again. Once it's steady, we just rest. Just rest and receive the benefits of allowing the heart to just rest in this field of compassion. And just resting. And then as we rest, just this being karuna, being compassion, we allow it to radiate out. Radiates to the front of you, to the right, front, right, and behind, front, right, and behind, to the left and right, above and below. And we don't need to concern ourselves with how far it's going to extend. And there are times when you're doing the practice where you can feel your heart and mind straining to like try to radiate it out as far as you can. You can just let that go. You just rest. You just to return to resting. And then once there's a kind of state of like a balanced relaxation with compassion, you just allow compassion to do what it does. Its nature is to radiate and move out and to bless in all directions. So you just allow it. You let it do what it does. You could even play with just resting in the metta and knowing that it's radiating out. You could just play with resting in the compassion and know that it's radiating out. Resting in the mudita and the equanimity and knowing that it's just radiating out. It's the nature of the Brahma Viharas. They're boundless, immeasurable, abundant, as the sutta says. The sutta reminds us. As you abide in the abundance of compassion, you may experience spaciousness, ease, seeing things clearly, seeing the conditions within your own heart and mind, feelings of rest and peace, the emptiness of the activity of craving. And what's so heartening about this, this is part of the awakening process, is that as we awaken and as greed and aversion and delusion start to abate, there's this responsiveness to life that's rooted in compassion and benevolence that can move through us, is radiating out. Not only the energetics of it, but the in our speech, our words, our actions. And we've been training in meditative compassion, karuna, for some time. And what's cool is to remember that karuna, this meditative compassion, purifies compassionate action in the world, anukampa. That's spelled A-N, as in Nancy, U-K-A-M-P-A, anukampa. And in the suttas, this Pali word anukampa is found in a very common phrase that just occurs throughout the suttas, out of compassion for all beings. This compassionate action, anukampa. So the cultivation of meditative compassion is rooted in ethical conduct. In fact, compassion is the wholesome intention that fuels ethical, verbal, and bodily conduct. Compassion is an expression of harmlessness, a heart that intends, it just intends not to harm anyone. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. Here, a noble disciple reflects thus, I shall abandon and abstain from the destruction of life. Sound familiar? Our first precept. A noble disciple reflects thus, I shall abandon and abstain from the destruction of life. With the rod and weapon laid aside, conscientious and kindly, I shall dwell compassionate towards all living beings, abiding compassionate towards all living beings as our North Star. Living with this ethically attuned heart, this heart that's asking, okay, what will be supportive? What will be for the well-being of myself and everybody, like all beings? The Majjhima Nikaya talks about it this way. One whose mind all day and all night takes delight in harmlessness. There's delight in compassion. We'll come back to this point later. Venerable makes it clear, Venerable Inalio makes it clear in his writings and his teaching that while abiding in compassion, the mind is temporarily liberated from greed, aversion, and delusion. This holding the vision of freedom in the heart-mind and resting in this boundless quality of compassion makes it difficult for the defilements to get a foothold in the heart-mind. It's like the heart-mind's protected by mindfulness, but and just by virtue of abiding in the divine abode of compassion, we're like weakening the defilements and planting seeds for the arising of compassion in the future. And the Buddha talked about it being a pleasant abiding here and now. I remember a yogi, I was in a practice meeting. We were working with these divine abodes of metta or loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, altruistic joy, or equanimity. And she said, it's such a balm. The balm is true. And it speaks to their very soothing and calming influence on the heart mind. I think one of the reasons that abiding in compassion can be so soothing is that there's delight and even like a joyous flavor, a joyous tone in the compassion. So I want to read a passage for you from Just Mercy, which is a memoir by Brian Stevenson. I'm sure most of you know who this human is. He's an African-American civil rights attorney. He and his colleagues at the Equal Justice Initiative created the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. And through that memorial, they're encouraging all of us, like an entire nation, to reflect soberly on our past about the racial discrimination and terror inflicted on African Americans to ensure a more just future. And he has an immense intelligence rooted in an even bigger heart that's really concerned for and like genuinely cares for all of the people as a society that we've relegated to the margins. So this is what Brian Stevenson said about what sounds to me like the joyous kind of flavor, the gladness, the delight in compassion. He says, when I was a college student, I had a job working as a musician in a black church in a poor section of West Philadelphia. At a certain point in the service, I would play the organ before the choir began to sing. The minister would stand, spread his arms wide and say, make me to hear joy and gladness, that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice. I love this image. Make me to hear joy and gladness, that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice. I don't know if you've been to a black church. I don't know if you've heard like all the joy and the gladness that just can radiate from the choir. And I think that joy and gladness is so connected to the present, current challenges of the people that our ancestors have faced. And like, we gotta live, we gotta continue to love. And it's that joy and that gladness. Make me to hear joy and gladness, that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice. And again, I love this because you get a felt sense of the joy that's inherent in compassion. And I know that may sound odd because the cause for the arising, the supportive condition for the arising of compassion is contact with suffering. And the focus of our mindfulness when cultivating compassion is not the suffering, but the wish that all beings or whoever we're bringing into our heart is free from affliction. And this is from Venerable Anālio's Emptiness and Compassion in Early Buddhism. He says, drawing a clear distinction between the realization that others are suffering and the wish for them to be free from suffering is important, since mentally dwelling on the actual suffering would be contemplation of dukkha. So this first noble truth, coming to understand dukkha. And this happens for us sometimes. We intend to cultivate compassion, but the mind just focuses on the difficulties and the hardships of the situation. The heart just starts to resonate with the dukkha, the difficulty, the affliction. And this would happen for me sometimes, like suffering became the object of mindfulness. And after some time, it would just wear away at my capacity to be mindful in a balanced way. So as a result of that lack of balance, I would just fall and collapse into sadness or overwhelm or fatigue. And I never quite understood, like during the long retreat where we'd be working with the Brahmavihara of compassion for a week, I would be like weeping and other people would be just fine. Didn't quite understand, like, what are y'all doing that I'm not doing? And to counter it, I would just practice equanimity. In cultivating compassion through meditation, this meditative development of compassion, the heart does come in contact with suffering. But then the focus widens to include not only the affliction, not only the difficulty, but the vision of freedom from the affliction. So it's with the dukkha, but there's the vision of freedom from the dukkha. It's compassion is wide. And it could be really easy to just focus on the freedom from affliction out of aversion to the suffering. And that's not what we're cultivating as we're working with compassion. That's not compassion. That's just aversion to suffering. Again, this is from Venerable Anālio. He says, the meditative cultivation of compassion can only lead to deeper concentration if it is undertaken with a positive or even joyful mind. There's a joy again. From a practical perspective, this means that one's cultivation of compassion needs to steer clear of sadness. This should ideally proceed from the opening of the heart that is genuinely receptive to the pain and suffering of others. So the state of compassion arises out of a steady and honest encounter with dukkha, honest encounter with suffering. And out of that steady contact, care and concern arises, and a genuine wish to alleviate dukkha fills the heart, fills the mind, fills the body. I think I've shared with you all that I was raised by three women. mama, my auntie, and my grandmother. Very, very fortunate. Three times the love, three times the difficulty in some instances. And my auntie B, who, as you know, died a couple of years ago. Auntie B is short for Barbara Ann. She was a trip. She was very funny, had a real body sense of humor. I remember taking her to a doctor during her last years, and the nurse was just examining her, and I guess the nurse had really cold hands, and my auntie said, "Oh, your hands are cold. You must be hell to make love to." And I was so mortified and embarrassed. But the nurse just laughed. And this just gives you a sense of who my auntie was. Like, she was in her body, very down to earth, kind of impish sense of humor. And during the last 2 years of her life, the gift that she gave me and my mother was allowing us to take care of her, allowing for us to care for her. And there are times when Auntie B would be in pain and my mom and I could actually alleviate that pain, right? But there are other times when she'd be in pain and we couldn't do that. However, just being with her lightened the burden of the physical pain that she was experiencing and the kind of mental anguish that comes with that physical pain, because she wasn't alone in her dying. I remember one time I was with my auntie, we're driving home from a mammogram appointment, and it was looking like she had breast cancer. And we didn't talk. We were pretty silent on the drive home. I think we were stunned, really like incredulous. I cannot speak for her, but I was feeling really indignant. And I remember looking over at my auntie, her spine like curved and her head, just shaking her head side to side. It was like, really, on top of everything, like breast cancer, on top of the gastroparesis and the diabetes and the loss of vision and the physical pain, breast cancer too. So I could understand why, like, because I was feeling it too. But just this heavy shape of her body, this C curve of her spine and her just shaking her head. And I remember saying to her, and I do not have a great memory. I remember saying to her, Auntie B, we're all dying. But right now, you're dying a lot louder and a lot faster than anybody I know. And she laughed. And I laughed because she, just to see her light, just to light up. There was laughter and love, kinship in the dukkha. Make me to hear joy and gladness that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice. Okay. So developing compassion has a limit. This is from Venerable. He says, from an early Buddhist viewpoint, to cultivate compassion does not stand in conflict with withdrawing into meditative seclusion. As long as one's motive arises the aspiration to benefit others, regularly retreating for death is certainly an integral part of the cultivation of compassion. And I bring this in because sometimes when we've taken time for dedicated practice, even just carving out time on a Sunday evening, we can start to think, is this even okay? In this era of COVID and the economic fallout around it, with people, like, there's so much need in the world right now. The racial injustice and the violence and discrimination that transgender people are experiencing, and the political dysfunction and the climate crisis. It's like, is taking time to practice a valuable use of my gifts and my time when there's so much hardship right now? And the practice that we do, whether it's in our daily lives or taking time to be on retreat, as Gil reminds us, it's the sacred work, it's the preparation, the sacred work of caring for each other in this world. Again, this is from Venerable. In fact, to some extent, it could even be considered a requirement for proper compassionate activity to do so, inasmuch as dedicated training of the mind lays the proper foundation for being able to react with patience and compassion when interacting with others. The more the mind is purified from the defilements, the better one will be able to react compassionately and thereby truly benefit others. So I want to show you another lovely being. This is Professor Loretta J. Ross. She's been described as a radical activist on issues of human rights. She's an author and academic, and right now she's a visiting professor over at Smith College. And she's currently teaching a class called Calling in the Call-Out Culture. So Calling in the Call-Out Culture. And Calling in, she says, is just calling out done with love. And if you're not familiar with this call-out term, I think we all are. If you're not familiar with this, it's just a way of publicly shaming someone, publicly blaming them for behavior that is deemed unacceptable or inappropriate. And just to give you a sense of who she is and her critique of the call-out culture, I want to share some of her thoughts with you. Because I feel like she is embodying compassionate action in the world. She's not a Buddhist, but you don't need to be a Buddhist to like live and embody compassionate action. And the source of these quotes is from an article written by Jessica Bennett of the New York Times. So she's teaching a course at Smith called White Supremacy in the Age of Trump. And then she's also teaching a class called Reproductive Justice. And she tells her students, if you need a trigger warning or a safe space, I urge you to drop this class. She says, I think we overuse the word trigger when really we mean discomfort. And we should be able to have uncomfortable conversations. She says, I'm challenging the call-out culture. I think you understand how calling out can be toxic. It really does alienate people and make them fearful of speaking up. She says, I think we really sabotage our own happiness with this unrestrained anger. I don't know if you've noticed the kind of anger that kind of fuels and animates this calling out. She says, I think we actually sabotage our own happiness with this unrestrained anger. And I have to honestly ask, why are we making choices to make the world crueler than it needs to be and calling that being woke? I love this woman's critique. I love it. And this article describes Professor Ross's efforts as it says that calling in what she's, so Professor Ross thinks the counter to calling out is calling in. And she says it's calling out, but done with love. And the article expresses her efforts in this way, this calling in. Calling in involves conversation, compassion, and context. Calling in involves conversation, compassion, and context. It doesn't mean a person should ignore harm, slight, or damage, but nor should she, he, or they exaggerate it. And this is Professor Ross. She says, every time somebody disagrees with me, it's not verbal violence. Professor Ross said, overstatement of harm is not helpful when we're trying to create a culture of compassion. So she's dedicating her time to creating a culture of compassion on our college campus, not far from here with our young people. She also did this as the director of research at a center called Center for Democratic Renewal, which monitored hate groups. And C.T. Vivian, who was a civil rights activist and a part of Martin Luther King's inner circle, he was her supervisor. C.T. Vivian is no longer with us. And he told her something that left a lasting impression on her heart and mind that she's been living into ever since. And you can feel this in her work at Smith College around calling in and calling out. And this is what he said to her. He said, when you ask people to give up hate, you have to be there for them when they do. When you ask people to give up hate, you have to be there for them when they do. So she did this as the director of research at this organization, the Center for Democratic Renewal. And she would be on mountaintops with like women who were part of families that had members who were part of the Ku Klux Klan. And she'd be teaching them anti-racism. She'd go into prisons with men who had were part of sexual violence, that perpetrated sexual violence. And she would use an experience from her own life and then teach them Black feminist theory in the process. Like, this is somebody living compassionate action in the world. And this is from the article in the New York Times. Sometimes in those years, this was in the 90s, Professor Ross found herself on a street corner in Janesville, Wisconsin, in the dead of winter, watching as Kim Peterson, a defector from the KKK, filmed an interview with the Geraldo Rivera Show. Mr. Peterson and his wife Carol had to flee their home quickly. And as Miss Peterson was shivering in the cold. And this is Loretta J. Ross. She said, I stood there for the first half hour watching the wife of this defector of the Ku Klux Klan. I stood there for the first half hour watching her. And at some point, I made the decision to share my coat with her, Professor Ross said. I just couldn't maintain that anger. So here is this professor, this human, using her gifts and her skills to create a culture of compassion in prisons, rural areas, supporting people getting out of the Ku Klux Klan, calling people in, calling out done with love, just bringing the light of compassion to the darkness of dukkha. So I want to leave us with a celestial image of compassion. That's the sun at sunset. Again, this is from Venerable Anaya. This is what he says of this image associated with compassion, the celestial image of compassion. Darkness is close, almost palpably close, yet the sun keeps shining. In fact, it shines all the more brilliantly, beautifully coloring the sky at sunset. Similarly, when being face to face with suffering and affliction, the mental attitude of compassion shines even more brightly, undeterred by all the darkness found in the world. Let's just sit for a moment, let it all settle.